You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Doing well. Glenn Lowry here at The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. Professor at Brown University, talking with my friend and colleague and Blogging Heads conversation partner, John McWhorter of Columbia University. We are the black guys at bloggingheads.tv, John.
Well, we're going to stay that way.
Been that way for nearly a decade, if I'm counting correctly.
I think we're the longest running pair. That's right.
So, and we are here. This is an ongoing conversation that you and I have been having on a couple of different issues to today talk about the race and IQ controversy. You had a long and interesting piece in National Review.
I did.
John, National Review is a magazine founded by William F. Buckley. It was the Bible of the conservative movement for many years. What are you doing publishing in National Review? Are you now a conservative, John?
No, I never was, but I don't think that in principle conservatives are evil, and I've always known the National Review crowd to an extent. And, you know, quite frankly, and I hope I'm not insulting the National Review, but who else was going to publish the piece? Because my piece actually allowed that there might be an on-the-average IQ gap between black people and other
people. Okay, we're going to get to that. That piece is about the race and IQ controversy, and I want you to elaborate on exactly what you're saying. I just want to put on the table the other issue that everybody is talking about, which is the Trump-Russia investigation. I allowed in a social media comment recently that I was less enthusiastic than most of my friends and colleagues and associates about driving Donald Trump out of office on the impetus of this collaborated with Russia, colluded with Russia kind of argument, and got a deluge of critical reaction for having even raised the question of whether or not it's a good idea.
Glenn, you almost seem to enjoy it.
To enjoy the deluge?
Yeah.
Why do I keep saying things that I know people are going to get mad at me for? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I don't do that on Facebook. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why invite it? Is it constructive for you?
Okay. Again, let's carry that conversation forward in its proper context. Of course, that will be one question, and I'm happy to be psychoanalyzed by you, John McWhorter.
Thank you. But yes, it did excite a deluge. And it's a very interesting view that you have, as always. And I disagree with you on it for a very principled reason where I feel like the soft one as opposed to you. But we will get to that. Should we do race and IQ or Trump first?
Why don't you tell me and the audience, I've read the piece, but I don't mind hearing from you again, what you're up to in the National Review talking about the race IQ controversy.
Okay. Well, needless to say, a couple of highly respectable places turned it down for reasons that I frankly found flimsy but understandable. So I published it in the National Review. They've been very nice about it. They also published a couple of responses that disagreed with me, very civilized responses, one from Robert Verbruggen and one from Brian Boutwell. But what I said was pretty simple, although I think some people, and I watched a long debate about it on Twitter, didn't participate because I do not do Twitter debates. I don't understand how you can have an intelligent discussion in 140 characters of time, but I certainly watched these things. I was saying that although free speech is important, and that the topics that we bar from considering free speech should be a very small set, that I find myself thinking that the race and IQ question is something that should not be recreationally discussed among intelligent people the way, for example, affirmative action or cultural appropriation, or even something like what the biological differences between men and women might be, should be. And I said that the reason that those things should not be discussed, they can be studied academically, but we're not going to have undergraduates bringing up the race IQ gap in class. I don't think that Time Magazine or The Atlantic needs to sponsor a forum where they're earnestly exploring this IQ gap rather than, for example, just dumping on Charles Murray. I think something should not be up for discussion because the reason being that when it comes to the specific issue of race and IQ, I can't see what any constructive outcome could be. So it's not that I can't imagine how some human beings might want to discuss it because of agendas of their own. But in terms of constructive outcome for society, if you want to say that the race, and there are three things, and I think I should enumerate what they are. If you want to say that the IQ gap means that we need to pull back on legislation designed to bring black people to parity with whites, well, frankly, you might say that. And a lot of people in the Twitter feed said it and seemed to think I was missing some sort of point. But America is never going to engage upon that. That is not something that our government is going to do. There could never be a consensus to do it. So why talk about it? Second, some people might think, and I think this is actually more interesting, it could be a piece itself. Suppose we said, because of this IQ gap, we're going to work harder to bring black people to parity with everybody else. I don't think that black America would ever accept the idea that, yes, we are on the average, and you know, everybody I know, on the average, but still, on the average, congenitally less intelligent than other groups, and so we're going to need this help. That would never be accepted. And so it's just off the table. There's no point in talking about it. And then finally, third, some people have said, and Charles Murray says this, and I have been in communication with him. I don't think I'm misrepresenting him in this. Brian Boutwell, my friend, we are colleagues. We talk about these things online. This is what he thinks, is that we need to learn to value individuals for something other than just this thing called G, that there are all sorts of ways of being a valuable person. And I completely understand that point. But as human beings in a society where we will always cherish the thing called intelligence, and intelligence intelligence, not as Howard Gardner means it, but as we all mean it, logical mathematical intelligence, as Gardner puts it. I don't see it. I don't see that we're going to have, for example, the black race saying, okay, yeah, we're not great on that smart mathy stuff, but, you know, we're good what? Musicians, basketball players, we're empathetic, please. So those are the three things, and they're the only three I could think of. And a lot of people drag out those three. Thank you for letting me go on so long. I'm practically done. A lot of people drag out those three, and their idea seems to be, dummy, don't you understand? This is why we need to talk about race and IQ. No, I know, folks, but I'm saying no. Those things would never lead to any kind of actual constructive discussion in society occupied by the human beings that we are. That was my piece.
Okay, that's a good summary. That's what I read. Let me try to respond to you at two levels. I won't do it all in one go, but one level is a kind of meta level. Mm-hmm. You say, we don't need to talk about it because you don't know what the point is. And I might challenge the idea that there needs to be a point in order mm-hmm. to talk about something. So that's one kind of response. I just want mm-hmm. to put on the table. I'll come back to it. But the other is just to review these three different things that you're talking about, which I can, with your permission, perhaps reduce to no affirmative action, more affirmative action, mm-hmm. and it's okay because y'all can play ball.
That is perfect. Yeah, including the third one. Yeah.
So your claim is that none of that works. No affirmative action doesn't work because we're committed to, I'm just saying affirmative action, but of yeah. course I mean the broad programmatic effort to bring about racial yeah. equality. Because we're committed to the project of bringing about racial equality, which will never be discredited, even if you could establish that blacks had a genetic lower IQ tendency.
Right.
More affirmative action. Well, affirmative action in and on itself is patronizing enough. More of it is going to be even more patronizing. So blacks become the special wards of the state. We know they're not quite so bright on average, but nevertheless, we're going to boost them. That's unacceptable. And then finally, okay, you're not quite as smart, but that doesn't mean you're not as valued. We value you for your musical talents or your emotional intelligence or whatever, and you say, right. that won't fly. Now, the constraints that you are accepting are not obviously unbreachable to me. So no affirmative action. So we both work in elite universities, which are highly selective and which have diversity goals. And whether that goal is 10%, 6%, or 4% of the undergraduate student body being African-American, I just make those numbers up, is consequential. It matters a lot in terms of, for example, what would be the academic achievement gap of the marginally admitted African-American student if the goal were 10% compared to mm-hmm. the rest of the student body versus if it were 6% or 4%? That matters a lot. So how one would settle upon what is a reasonable target for boosting African-American representation in elite universities and in technical programs of study and employment in technical and engineering disciplines and things like that, where you might think that that raw intelligence was an important factor in generating people's success in those fields. Mm-hmm. How you calibrate whatever the affirmative action is that you might want to do could be influenced by your views about the basis, the extent and the basis of intelligence differences in the population. So I'm not sure the fact that we are committed to a racial equality project means that information about race and IQ differences would be completely irrelevant. That's one thing I'd like you to respond to. Mm-hmm. More affirmative action, you say, would be patronizing. I think we're getting more patronization with each passing year and decade of African American mm-hmm. populations, and not just with respect to academic or intellectual performance. I'm not sure that the reparations advocates, for example, mm-hmm. aren't wallowing in and relishing the idea that the country would understand African American subordinate economic and social position as a terrible blight that requires white people or mainstream institutions to bend over backwards to boost, to promote, to support, to and so forth and so on, African Americans. So it's not obvious to me that the conclusion that you draw is that if we were to recognize that there was some genetic basis to the racial IQ difference, that the country would be more committed to trying to bring blacks in, notwithstanding this deficit. And this is all very hypothetical. I put all this in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. It's not obvious to me that would necessarily be something that would be rejected by African Americans, because leading advocates for the social justice program seem already to be in a patronized posture, if you ask me. But I wholeheartedly agree with you that this doesn't fly, this idea that I think Charles Murray originally put this formulation forward at the time the bell curve was published in the mid-1990s. All right, not all groups are equal in all respects of human performance, and, you know, what's the big deal? Some people are smarter than other people. Some groups, on average, are smarter than other groups. What's the big deal? The issue is to arrange society so that everybody is valued. I agree with you that there's something about intellectual performance that is special. I loved very much the sentence in your piece where you say, John Coltrane what do you call him? He's a king, but Albert Einstein is a god. Virtuosity with respect to something like musical talent or Michael Jordan or John Coltrane is one thing, but redefining physics and our understanding of the universe based upon, you know, almost transcendent genius is something entirely different. And
always will be.
Always will be. But what I want to stress about that is that that's not everybody. That's not 1 in 100. That's not 1 in 10,000. That's 1 in 1,000,000. I mean, when you start talking about people like that, you're not talking about groups anymore. You're talking mm-hmm. about genius. You're talking about, now the relative number of such people may be different in different population groups, but it's always going to be a very, very, very tiny fraction of the population. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, see, those are some reactions.
Those are great responses, and you basically agree with me. And I'm going to tick off the three reasons why. First of all, let's call it we're going to get rid of affirmative action. And you're saying, well, that perspective might inform whether or not racial preferences at a university are made to be 4, 6, or 10%. You know, it might not be getting rid of affirmative action completely. But if this sort of thing were known, yes, that's true. But the thing is, nobody could put it in cold black and white. We're talking about the idea that race and IQ are discussed explicitly. I work at Columbia. Lee Bollinger is a very good man. But there is no way that he would ever have memos or give fundraising talks where he said, because it's been proven that African-American students are slightly less intelligent on the average, we therefore are going to have this percentage of them in our classes as opposed to others who are, you know, accepted under different standards.
May I just make a comment? Excuse me for interrupting. No, he would never give that speech, but he might say, because the SAT test score gap amongst our applicants by race is what it is, instead of going for population parity, we are going to have a more modest, but what we think is still, robust and representative target. We're going to go 5% and not 10%.
Would he even say that out loud? You know, the SAT gap, as you know, the minute you bring it up, you were treated as if you said, let's go back to trying to exterminate the Jews. You're not even supposed to talk about it. It's in books. But the minute you mention it, it's assumed, unless you say that there's an SAT problem because people are poor, when you bring up the fact that even in the middle class there's an SAT gap with Black and Latino students, you're treated as if you don't deserve to be part of polite society. I don't think that Lee Bollinger would ever bring that up wearing a blazer talking to important people. Do you really?
That's to his discredit. I don't, maybe. You know Lee Bollinger better than I do, but I take your point that a college administrator has to be very careful in talking about racial performance differences. I, for example, cannot find out at Brown whether or not there are any racial differences in the rate at which students are put on academic probation for underperformance in their courses. I'm sure that information is known, but it's not known. Nobody's going to tell it to me.
And the service is not going to give it to you. Yeah, you have to get it through somebody else, basically.
But you can't run a university without paying attention to the intellectual achievement of your students. To not pay attention to that, for example, means that you wouldn't orient your pedagogy appropriately. So, for example, if I know that my African-American students on average are coming in with a weaker preparation, there may be then the need to have, not only for African-American students, but for any students who could benefit from it, remediation that addresses the deficits in their academic preparation so that they can take full advantage of the university. These are diagnostic tools, in other words, that would guide how it is that you deal with a student after the student came in. If I found that there was vast underrepresentation in the science and technology and engineering disciplines at my university of African-American students, that might concern me. And if I discovered that they were disproportionately majoring in, and I mean no disrespect to anybody's field, softer disciplines, then, you know, and we can name them, but since everybody knows what they are, that might concern me. So this is, I'm saying it's useful. The test score information is useful. I'm not really addressing the question of the genetic basis of it.
Sure. Yeah, that's a diagonal relationship. Second, the idea that we are going to use the IQ gap in order to say more affirmative action. Yes, there is massive patronization of Black people in the policies we don't even need to tick off. But you have to understand, the people who are so fiercely arguing for those think that Black people deserve to be patronized in that we are hobbled by socioeconomic conditions that are the spawn of racism. So the idea is it's not patronization. We must be treated differently because we've been given such a bad hand. To take that same person and imagine that they would say, it's been shown that we have a lower racial IQ and therefore we deserve this help. Never. Imagine Kimberly Crenshaw, Lanny Guinier, people like that. Those people aren't going to argue for Black people getting special attention on the basis of having a lower IQ. Just picture. I'm taking those two people because they've got IQs of about 700 and their politics are hard left. And you've probably met both of them. I know them both.
Lonnie is a friend of mine, as a matter of fact.
She would barely look me in the eye. But imagine those people confronted with this IQ issue. Just forget it. And so it would be, if you do know Lonnie Guinier and Kimberly Crenshaw, you know that nothing constructive could come of that. And I'm using them as representatives of a general way of looking things. And finally, the third thing, you agree, it's not going to be that, well, y'all can play ball. It simply won't work. And it's not only the 1 in 1,000,000 argument. You know, whatever I said about Coltrane and Einstein, that was for rhetoric's sake. But in general, I mean, how would you feel? I think, frankly, you and I are both kind of arrogant. But how would you feel if it were established among all the people who judge us, the people who we sit drinking our white wine with in rooms, that, well, you're, I mean, frankly, I think a lot of them think it quietly anyway, but suppose it were overt. You guys come from a group that aren't as bright. You know, all on the average, yeah, but still. You guys come from that, and some of that is in you. Not quite as bright. I wouldn't want that overtly. Well, it's not only the 1 in 1,000,000.
Not only would I not want that, I wouldn't want to be told you're smarter than anybody I ever met, which is kind of meant to be. I mean, I get that.
I know what you mean.
Of course, you're the smartest person in the room, but
Right.
Which invites me to collude in the denigration of my own people.
I know exactly what you mean. And sometimes that you're the smartest person I've ever met, you can't help thinking what they really mean is the smartest black person, but they kind of left that out. So there's enough of it subliminally. So what imagine it being... Imagine it being overt. I just don't see how any of that would work in the America that we live in, as opposed to in theory.
Okay, and so I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
You get it. I'm done.
Yeah. No, I want to go back to my meta, which is because there's no good use of the talk, we shouldn't talk that way. And I want to object to that by saying that the way that science works often is that things which prove to be very useful in the end come to be understood and known as a consequence of a series of apparently esoteric and, you know, abstract and unconnected to practicality inquiries as people try to understand the basic foundations of whatever the phenomenon is that they're studying. So that if I want to understand intelligence, just in general, not necessarily with respect to race at all, if I want to understand what's going on in producing the different levels of intellectual performance that I can see in a population of human beings, what's going on in the brain that is responsible for cognitive capacity and performance in people, what's going on in the environment, genetic interaction that influences these outcomes. The fact that I have human populations that have, evolved or developed in relative geographic isolation from one another, such as in Europe or East Asia or Africa, and that then, in a society that includes people from all these different backgrounds, evidences significant and measurable differences in intellectual performance, that fact might be a useful entree, and I invite people who know a lot more about the science of this to correct me if I'm wrong, into gaining a better understanding of what intelligence is, how it works, what's going on in the brain that is being reflected in people's cognitive performances, and what factors, what specific genetic factors, if any, are involved. Okay, there's no single IQ gene. Maybe there's a group of genes, whoever, whatever. Again, I don't know enough about this to be more precise, but the idea is that one wants to understand the foundations of human intelligence, and using all available information, including racial differences in intelligence, might be useful. Mm-hmm. Not only to understanding the foundation, but perhaps also to fashioning interventions, the better the foundations are understood, that would be useful. I mean, so let me just give the obvious sort of analogy here is some people are farsighted, some people are nearsighted, et cetera. Not everybody sees as well as everybody else. There could be, I mean, we understand why people see well or not pretty well. We understand how the eye works and focusing light on the retina and all that. But and so corrective lenses can be introduced, and notwithstanding the fact that some groups of people might be disproportionately nearsighted at birth, everybody is pretty much equally sighted once we don the relevant corrective lens. Corrective lenses for cognitive development based upon early childhood intervention that is aimed at remedying whatever we understand to be the structural foundation for low intellectual performance could erase the black-white IQ difference in adulthood if we could understand the foundations of the cognitive ability performance better and figure out how to intervene. That kind of argument. So how do you respond to that?
Glenn, you have sparked my brain because it's interesting. I am engaged in an exchange with an expert in psychometric issues. I'm going to not name them, and I'm going to try and always fail to not have gender. Okay. And this person tells me that this whole conversation that we're having, frankly, is going to seem a little 5 years ago in 5 years because they are just on the edge of knowing what the genetic components of these things are. So no, there is no IQ gene. It's lots of genes, but that doesn't mean that we're never going to know what the lots are, and we're about to. It's going to be in either 5 or 10 years that you can just say that it's these. And that the average differences between the races, if there are any, and there almost certainly are just going to be incontrovertible. Now, I have told this person, frankly, given the politics of it, this person seems to think that the people who argue that there's no significant IQ gap or that it's only about environment and not heredity, he thinks that he thinks that all those people are just going to fold because the data is so clear, and then we can move on into the discussion that he wants to have about all these things. And I have said, no, I mean, if academia is itself, the way I've seen it in my own neck of the woods, and even in myself, in my heart of hearts, people don't give up that easily. And there are going to be all sorts of very clever ways of denying what is in front of everybody's faces, all sorts of different interpretations. But let's say that what he says actually comes true, and in 10 years, people like Richard Nisbet have to just admit that there is a difference. On the average, of course, but that there is a difference. Now, you're talking about this. Here is one use that would come from it, and it would be a very interesting conflict. There'd be people on one side insisting that there's no difference because that's what they had always said, and that's the way they want it to be. Then there would be people on another side who would say, but no, there is a difference, and we know how to fix it. And so, especially with CRISPR and this new gene therapy, we can make it so that everybody has a certain basic IQ from a very early age. We can squirt somebody with something, and there you go. There's going to be, if I were a sci-fi person, this would be a novel. How would you decide between the people at Yale, whatever, who would argue until their dying day that there's no difference, and that if you think there is one, you're a racist, and the people from wherever they would be who would say, we've got this serum, and this will take care of the whole business? I wonder where people would fall. That's what you're making me think about.
Okay.
Interesting, isn't it? So, yes, that would be nice. Once we found out what the difference was, if there's a difference, you can tell what creates high intelligence. And then we're getting to the point where we could give it to anybody who wanted it. That's a brave new world.
Okay.
So I guess we'll see.
So here's something that's not intelligence, but it's not dissimilar. There's huge racial differences in violence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, homicide. Robbery and assault.
Apparently there's some genetic data on that, according to a couple of people I've been talking to. Anyway, go
ahead. No, that's what I wanted to pursue. I wanted to pursue whether you would think that asking the question, is there a, you know, biophysical, neurological, endocrinological, you know, cognitive basis for that? James Q. Wilson and Richard Herrnstein, Mary's co-author on the Bell Curve, had a book 10 years before the Bell Curve appeared that was called Crime and Human Nature.
You know, and, I didn't know that.
Yeah, in that book, they explore the literatures that have emerged studying the extent to which criminal behaviors can be understood as reflecting basic constitutional factors, you know, about how people's bodies and brains are working, inclining them more or less so to engage in criminal action. It discussed race, not mainly, but they did have a chapter on race in the book and the racial differences in criminal offending, which, if I recall correctly, they took to be at least indirect evidence that there were constitutional factors that were implicated in criminal
behavior.
What do
you mean constitutional?
Oh, I mean like your...
I know you mean biology.
Yeah, yeah, I mean like biology and I mean, whether you're impatient or not, right. Whether you have impulse control or not, what your body size and physical presentation are, how much relative testosterone to other, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I reveal my ignorance just by trying to answer your question.
Constitution, right.
But here's the point that I'm getting at. The point I'm getting at is the numbers, the disparity is huge, and the consequence for the quality of life, you know, just read about what's going on in the city of Chicago these days. Just the other day, a former gang member, an OG, an old gangster, a guy who had become, they called him the mayor of 95th Street because he was such an activist, anti-violence worker. He had been a gangster and a gang member, and he had flipped over. He'd probably served time in prison. He came back. He was trying to, you know.
He was trying to make a difference, right?
Just trying to make a difference. Man, some guys rolled up next to him, pulled out an AR-15. That's an assault rifle, a military weapon, and blew him away, shot him in the mouth. Shot him in the mouth and in the chest. They beckoned him over to the car. He comes over, and they assassinate him. This is an African-American street worker, former gang member, former incarcerated person who's out there trying to keep the kids from killing each other, and he got knocked out. Anyway, that's an anecdote. What I'm trying to get at is the violence is affecting the quality of life of lots of people. Is it okay to inquire into whether or not there are psychological and biophysical roots of a predilection to violence that might have a racial aspect to them that could help to account for the huge racial disparity in violence, but that also might give us some clues into what's actually going on with this behavior and how it could be avoided.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And I mean, you should be able to ask the question. And of course, the answer that many people would give is that other groups, immigrant groups in the not so distant past, were given to very similar behavior, just with different technologies, such as the Irish are usually brought up, or Southern Europeans in underserved American neighborhoods, and therefore this can't be traced to anything about Africans. I think Tom Sowell would say that Black Americans have been infected by the Scotch-Irish culture that has become quote-unquote redneck culture here. But then on the other hand, it is interesting to think, everybody talking about, I've brought this up before, how racism is at the heart of all Black problems, or Ta-Nehisi Coates has an in itself articulately put way of saying there isn't anything wrong with Black people that white supremacy, the end of white supremacy wouldn't solve.
Ending white supremacy wouldn't fix.
Right. The hardest thing for that, the one that you can't ever hear a real answer for, is why are Black teenagers killing each other in Chicago over sneakers? How is that due to racism? And, you know, even the most articulate of the usuals end up basically creating word salad in explaining that. They don't feel any love. Society doesn't like them. They have no opportunity. None of it holds up. So that's the sort of thing that I imagine would lead to your question. Although then I find myself thinking Irish kids would have been doing the same thing except with knives and rocks 125 years ago.
I think I think if you look carefully, the scale of the current situation is vastly greater than what was characteristic of earlier immigrant communities. But that's an empirical question, and I'm not an expert. But that would be my hunch. But let me just do one more thing on this first topic, and then we can switch over to the Trump, and that is culture, because you make in your article in the National Review a point out of saying, you think you know what's going on. It's not about biology or genes. It's about culture, and you talk about a pre-literate and highly oral cultural orientation in African-American experience going back, and how that probably is implicated in the average differences between racial groups in measured IQ performance. Talk a little bit more about that, because that's controversial too, John.
Yeah, that's, you know, how I first became public enemy number one among a certain crowd, by making that kind of argument. And yet I still can't help making it. And I was going by the seat of my pants. I openly say in the article that I'm going on a hunch. And I can't be sure that my hunch is correct. I say I hope that the reason is not IQ, but that I said that Black culture has an inheritance of its history as an oppressed, and because of that oppressed Depression, mainly old-based culture, which was denied access to the printed page beyond roughly the Bible, and really, you know, very few people even had access to that in terms of print. And the oral way of thinking is different from the print way of thinking in terms of how one deals with the issue of cause and effect beyond the very basic aspect of it, the extended argument, thinking hypothetically versus pragmatically, the sort of thinking that we think of as natural as literate Westerners, no matter what kind of literate Westerner we are, is actually much less fundamental to Homo sapiens than we often think. And when you deal with people who are strictly oral, and this first research was done with very white peasants in Asia, you find that there are different ways of reasoning, and there are kinds of reasoning that aspects of the IQ test go beyond. So it's always seemed to me that when it comes to something like an IQ test, and because my mother was a child psychologist, I took an awful lot of them when I was young, so I do know what they consist of or what they consisted of in the 70s and 80s. The kind of reasoning that those tests are asking for is something that people who were raised in an orally based culture might be at a disadvantage of. And orally based means that, you know, in the modern world, there will be some books. But if there's a general sense that real life is not in the books, which is what I was explicitly told by my Southern relatives who were older and who were modestly educated when I was a kid. They said it with love, but they said, life is not in them books. You're supposed to be out here in the world talking to people. They were warning me against being too nerdy, and they meant it lovingly, and I say in the piece they were happy to see their children graduating from high school and college. But the book, to them, print, was something other. You dealt with that if you had to, but that wasn't something that you aspired towards. I suspect that that has an effect not only on IQ tests, but on SAT performance, LSAT performance, and most importantly, I suspect that it would set in at a very early age. And I say that now, especially because raising small children, I can see that it's not as if Dahlia and Vanessa get taught anything terribly explicitly, but they have watched me and my wife. Dahlia is now 5 and a half. We have books in our hands, and more to the point, the kind of conversation that's around them, what is considered important to talk about, how it's talked about in the hypothetical, and giving several reasons for something instead of just saying that's the way it is and forget it. I think that can change somebody. That can shape somebody very early on. And the hardest part of this is that I think, and this is part of why everybody, you at the time, apparently, everybody hated my book, Losing the Race, because I said that even if you are an educated middle-class black person, there can be parts of you that harbor aspects of that frame of mind which would have been passed on to you by those nearest and dearest to you. In the same way, as I say in my latest book, that, you know, most black people have certain subtle aspects of the way they speak that nobody could control. You just drink it in. I suspect that's it. Yeah.
Okay, on the substance of argument that you're making about culture and IQ, I want to observe that there are many kinds of IQ tests. For example, I can write down a string of numbers, and I can ask you to repeat the numbers. I can, you know, cell 6, 8, 5, 3, 2, 7, and then I can ask you to repeat 6, 8, 5, 3, 2, 7. Then I can go to 6 numbers, and then 7, and then 8, and then 9, until you're unable to answer correctly in repeating the series that I just spoke out. I can ask you to repeat the numbers backwards. Okay, I give you a string of numbers, I ask you to repeat them backwards. And I can do that over and over again, and I can observe your performance at that task. My impression in the psychometrics field is that simple tests like that can produce results in populations that are relatively highly correlated with more conventional IQ tests. I can say A is to B as X is to Y, and then there's a multiple choice about Y, and what you have to understand is what's the relation between A and B, and look for that same relation between X and the various candidate Ys and pick the right Y in a multiple choice, and I can measure your intelligence in that way. So it doesn't only have to be an IQ test of the SAT or an intelligence test of the SAT variety. And those measures of human intelligence correlate with other more. What this reminds me, in other words, what I'm trying to say is I'm not sure that you're right that the intelligence gap is purely a function of people's culturally oriented differences in responding to, you know, certain kinds of problem solving. There was this guy named Robert Sternberg, who was a professor of psychology at Yale for many years. And he wrote some books that I read around the time that the bell curve came out, because I was trying to educate myself about the subject. Long story short is he has this concept. He says, what is intelligence? It's the capacity to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And then he observes that different circumstances will throw up different sets of problems for human beings to solve. And if I want to measure their intelligence, I have to use instruments that are ecologically valid, which is to say that ask them to solve the kind of problems that people in their environment are typically confronted with solving. Mm-hmm. And if I want to compare different groups of people, I don't use the same test necessarily to measure their intelligence, because if those groups have different circumstances, different environmental circumstances, the kinds of problems that. So, for example, you know, Mary and Herrnstein in their book recite some evidence about testing African populations in Kenya and in South Africa and finding that they test lower than European populations on the same test. But the Sternberg type argument would be, well, the same test is not as ecologically valid a measure of the problem-solving challenges that people are facing in these different environments and so on and so on. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of put that on the table.
Very, very quickly to straddle myself and your view on that. I know what you mean, but this hunch, and once again, it's a hunch. You know, I have not studied this scientifically, but I feel this as strongly as when you smell a certain something, you know it's going to rain. As soon as you mentioned this, I thought, but, which is that if you take some hypothetical little white girl of 3, and she's from the classic book lined home. I'm not going to give her name because it sounds like stereotyping, and it'd be even worse if I
did that last time, John. You gave her name.
And people don't like that. So
her name was Sarah, as I recall.
because her name is Sarah. And so let's say Sarah, and you tell Sarah, here are some numbers. I'm picturing Sarah. And here's some seven numbers, and now say it backwards. And now you take a little black girl, and she lives in a black home that is a perfectly fine home, but not as many books line it as Sarah's. And there are all sorts of subtle cultural differences in what is considered funny, what is watched on TV, just what discipline is like. She lives in that environment, and that little girl, hey, I can't give her a name, but that little girl is asked, okay, here's seven numbers, now do it backwards. It's not so much that she can't do it, it's that she wouldn't want to. Her sense is that, why would I want to be bothered with such a thing? And she just kind of resists it. Whereas Sarah would be more likely to think of it as a kind of a game. Now, that is because of the sorts of things that are done around Sarah. And notice that there's no value judgment here. But yeah, you know, if, and frankly, I openly admit that Sarah is my kids, black though I am. If that were given to Dahlia or Vanessa, they think, oh, well, one of them more than the other. I can already tell them to be, But frankly, you know, not too far from here, there are little girls who could, but it would just be, why would you want to do that? And they would get barked down.
Yeah. Let me just say...
They wouldn't say why. This wouldn't be game.
Sorry, you just froze up there for a minute. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But
you froze too. Go ahead.
There's one thing I want to say, which is I didn't dislike your 2000 book, Losing the Race, because you said something about culture in that book. I dislike that book because you reported candidly on your interactions with African-American students when you were teaching at Berkeley and how you thought that they'd come into your office and ask for an extension on a paper or something. I mean, I get this exactly right, but the basic bottom line was you were reporting that they weren't pulling their own weight and they weren't behaving responsibly as students in the university, and I felt like you would tell tales out of school on your students, and that was reprehensible. But that was before I knew you, John.
That was a charge that many people made, and I should just say that I wrote those sections with great reluctance. I considered pulling that chapter, and also it was done in order to say this is by no means all of the black students, but I have had almost no white or Asian students who did what I've had so many black students do. And I was saying that the reason was not because black students are evil, but because of kind of what I've been talking about here, and that we needed to talk about culture and what you do about it, as well as, you know, racism that's imposed by society. A lot of people hated that. But anyway,
well,
Trump.
Okay, so here I'm going to give a very short spiel, okay? I'm concerned with the effort to drive Trump from office on the argument that his election was illegitimate because the Russians interfered on his behalf. Because I worry that it will, that what it is in fact is a way to try to reverse the outcome of the 2016 election by other means, and that Trump and his people won't go quietly. There could be real severe consequences to trying to undo the outcome of that election by the scandal mongering. This is all presupposing that indeed there's not a smoking gun that's going to come out somewhere. I'm looking at what I've seen so far, and I haven't been impressed. Even this meeting of Donald Trump Jr. with the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower doesn't impress me to the extent that it has impressed so many people as finally we got it. I don't know what they got. An attempt to collude. He went with the intention of colluding. I mean, you know, it just seems like it's reaching. But there are investigations ongoing. I think they should run their course. I think they should run their course promptly. I think they should come to definitive conclusions and not linger because it hurts the country. But I'm mainly worried that there was an election and that election was about something. Trump is Trump. Let's call him a jackass. Let's call him an asshole. Let's call him all these names and mean it. And mean it. Trump is Trump. But he's the person who was elected to be president of the United States by the people via the process that we have for deciding that. So he's the president. He's the people's president. You don't like what he stands for? Defeat him in what he stands for at the ballot box and in the court of public opinion. I'm not asking you to agree with him. I'm not asking you to not criticize him. I'm asking you to respect the outcome of the 2016 election. You're playing with fire. You're doing exactly what people accused Trump of intending to do when he was unable or unwilling to answer a direct question, will you accept the results of the election if you lose? People are not accepting the results of an election. Their problem is with the voters who voted Trump into office. If they don't find a better way of responding to what those voters were trying to say when they elected Donald Trump, they're going to hurt the country and they're going to hurt their own political prospects going forward. So that was the position I staked out. And you want to psychoanalyze me? Why would I go out there and say something like that? Because it needs saying, because I believe it to be true, because I value a quality of argument above herding behavior. I don't like bandwagons. I'm not getting on just because everybody on my corridor is saying something. I'm not going to jump on board on the basis of that. I don't care whether or not people think, oh, Glenn is some kind of closeted whatever. I'm not closeted. I won't be kept in the closet. So I'm concerned about the country. I mean, and I'll stop because I know you have a rebuttal of this. The maniacal, I mean, it's a kind of a feeding frenzy kind of thing that's going on here. I don't trust it. It feels profoundly undemocratic. I don't like being told by elites, even the elites who are running cable news networks and major newspapers. I don't like being told what to think and what to do. It feels to me like I'm being told what to think and what to do about this. They don't have any answers to the people who voted for Donald Trump. Donald Trump wants to build a wall on the Mexican border. I think that's a completely ridiculous idea. But I'm very interested in the fact that it's popular. To me, it demands more of me, the popularity of that idea, than to simply dismiss it as ridiculous. I have to try to understand what is motivating the people who see in that particular policy, and we could name other policies as well, and calling them racist, that's not an argument. You know, that's an ad hominem epithet. That's not an argument. People say, if you don't have a border, you don't have a country. I'm still waiting for Trump's enemies to tell me what's wrong with that claim. The claim is, I want my country, the integrity of my country. I want to have control over who comes into my country. When Trump says, if you love us and love our values, you're welcome. But if you don't love us and don't love our values, we don't want you. Again, I want to know what's racist about that. So if people want to have an argument about nationalism or internationalism or open borders or relatively open borders or whatever, let them have that argument directly. But don't try to short circuit a democratic process that produces an outcome on issues like that and others based upon this this kind of it's an end run around democracy.
You are correct in itself. But I guess my theme with this one is different. So I say race and IQ is different. I have to be inconsistent here, too. Yes, the media is quite biased on this. I think it's already clear that Russia is not going to get rid of Trump, and there is an obsessive interest in it. Yes, we are being told what to think. No, it won't do to say that Trump was elected because of racism. To an extent, it was because people are tired of being called racist. And I recommend, incidentally, this book, which is just out by Mark Lilla.
That book just came, man. They've asked me for a blurb. They asked me for a comment on the book.
You should blurb it.
It's in my bag. It's excellent. I'm literally reading the book right now. I just got started.
It's an incisive analysis. And no, all of that is true. But Glenn, this man's got to go. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, within my lifetime, to the extent that it's getting long enough that it's been 51 years and, you know, both of us know a certain amount about history. This won't do. Yes, this man was technically elected, but the Electoral College is ridiculous. And in this case, those people who elected him made a mistake. And I'm not saying that it's because they were racist. They thought that he would help them get their jobs back. I get it. They're tired of being called racist. I get it. They liked his charisma. Hillary doesn't happen to have any. I get it. But Glenn, quite simply, I mean, it's all been said, including by me and in this venue. But Trump isn't just different. He isn't just wrong. And he isn't just impulsive. He isn't just narcissistic. This man is a child. There's a person running the country who has no business doing it in a way that, you know, as everybody says, makes GW look like a statesman. And therefore, I am perfectly okay with an attempt to get rid of this man by almost any means necessary, even if the Russia stuff is stretched beyond a point that historians would completely agree with. This man's got to go, and here's why. I'm genuinely afraid that this boy, I'm not calling him names, it's true. I mean, frankly, I have stopped paying attention to anything that the man says because it's about as valuable as what Sarah or the other little girl we're talking about would have to say. He's a child. He shouldn't be in this position. John. And more to the point,
that's I'm afraid he's... John. No, I'm sorry, with respect, I find that ridiculous.
I don't want him to get us killed. I think that this man has no business with access to the metaphorical button. I want him gone, and I want it to be before 2020.
Well, then look, let me just I don't agree with everything that you just got through saying about Donald Trump, but I don't want to argue those points. So let me just bracket that. Let me accept that for the sake of argument. He's a bad person. He's a child. He's emotionally immature. He's unintelligent.
He's just a child. He is a bad person.
We live in a democracy. You don't like the Electoral College? Call it Constitutional Convention if you dare. Okay, there is no alternative to the Electoral College. That's in the Constitution. We're a country of laws. You can change those laws. There's a process for changing those laws. As the things now stand, that's how you elect presidents in the United States. Trump got elected. You want him gone? Have you got any idea what that means? There's a person in the office who I don't like, and I want him gone. By any means? You're subverting the foundational institutions of the country. Do you think it ends here? Do you think that this is the last president that somebody is going to think doesn't deserve to be in the office? Do you think that licensing the by any means necessary usurpation of the express will of the voters, licensing it because you think somebody is an asshole, you're playing with fire and you're debasing the currency, the political currency of the country, man. The institutions are more important than any personality.
Not when it's a child. This is special. Nelson Muntz from The Simpsons is running the country. He shouldn't be there.
And
he's going to hurt us.
Come on, John.
I really think that he is a very mere person. He doesn't have the mental capacity to do this job.
Man. You're reading too many Charles Blow columns. You need to get a grip.
I just got finished reading. I should pretentiously hold it up, but it's in the other room. John Farrell's new biography of Nixon. That was bad enough. And I know that there were people saying the same sort of thing then, but once again, Nixon was a statesman compared to this child. I mean, I'm appalled at what this man might create. That's part of why this is, because I've been reading about Nixon.
All right, but viewers,
I mean, understand, Glenn, I'm not saying that he's bad. It's not that. It's that I think he's mentally and emotionally underpowered for the office. He shouldn't be running a nation. You really don't agree with that, do you? That he's a special case?
No, I don't agree with that he's a special case.
And you were an adult during Nixon. You remember.
Nixon was Nixon. Let's not change the subject. That requires its own discussion. But I think Trump has a lot of flaws, okay? I didn't vote for him. I'm not endorsing him. All right. What I'm saying is we had an election. He's now the president of the United States. What I'm saying is talk about getting him out is dangerous talk. I hope that effort doesn't succeed. I believe if it were to succeed, even the people who advocated would live to regret it. It's a horrible precedent, and it's very dangerous to our democracy. You think Trump is a threat because he holds the office for 4 years? Pushing him out of that office because you think he's not smart enough for it and doesn't have the right personality for it, by bypassing the voters on that, that's a worse event than enduring 4 years of somebody in the office who might not be the most emotionally adjusted person. And I don't think we know that about Donald Trump, but that's a second matter altogether.
How do we know when we're at the end of history? How do we know when it's a legitimate special case where vigilante justice, and I certainly am not condoning violence or anything like that, but where metaphorically vigilante justice is necessary? There are times when historians decide that that kind of abrupt break was the way it needed to be.
That's what you do with Hitler. You smuggle a bomb into the conference bunker and you blow him up because he is a murderous, nation-destroying...
genocidal.
And you do it to save your people. This is not that. This is not anything close to that.
Would you say that if...
Have you seen Triumph of the Will? No, have you seen...
Yes, I have.
You know the film I'm talking about? Take a look at that film. I just went and watched it the other day. It blew me away. The year was 1936, if I recall. Hitler was at the height of his powers. This is, what's the guy's name? The filmmaker, I'll think of it.
It was a woman, Leni Riefenstahl.
It's a woman. You see, I didn't even know the filmmaker was a woman. Mm-hmm. But it's a very well-made documentary film of the Nuremberg Conference of the Nazi Party, 1936. Look at the way that those people are responding to Hitler. This is 1936. The war is still 3 years away. There is nothing similar in our contemporary political life to that. Not that you call Trump Hitler, but I'm just saying that's the kind of threat that I think could potentially justify your extraordinary position.
Technology is different now. I think that
John, we either have to stop or I have to get my power adapter because I'm going to lose battery power here in a moment.
In terms of our audience, we should stop because I'm sure we've been going over an hour. I think we can respectfully disagree on this one, but Trump's audience is kind of like Triumph of the Will. And I personally would like to see him gone because I'm afraid he's going to get us blown up.
All right, that's the last word. And I disagree. We'll obviously come back to this in the future.
We'll continue.
But I love you, John. I love you, man.
Love you too, Glenn.
Okay, take care.
You too. Right. You know, I think that was one of our best ones.
It was good.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.